He's in charge. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here this afternoon, particularly in the context of the generosity you were just mentioning in regard to time. Let's start by my asking you to give you your name and your place and date of birth so we get that on the card. I've got it on paper, obviously. But
okay, Anthony Kaplanis. I was born in 1936, July 20th, in Fort William.
Right. And could you tell us how you came to work in the grain industry, perhaps your earlier schooling and so on and so forth, perhaps, or did you get to it quite early in your life?
Well, I started the railway when I was 16 years old,
okay,
in 1952. And I worked various positions at the with CP till I was the deputy general yardmaster in 1972, and that's when they opened up the grain transportation agency here. There was an opening came up, and the fellow named Menzies, I don't know if you remember him, Ernie, he was the first grain coordinator in Thunder Bay. And he needed an assistant, and he asked me if I wanted to work with him, and I said yes. It was a better job. It was days. It was that sort of thing. So in 72, I went with the Grain Transportation Agency, and then it was later taken over by, originally it was Canadian Transport Commission, and then it was taken over by the Grain Transportation Agency, and I retired in 96.
When things were, well, that's, we can get into changes later on, but it was in the mid-90s, and a lot of things changed in transport, I guess.
That's right.
Right. Well, that's how you, the when of it, and the how as well. Could you tell us something about your work for the CPR before this all began? The various things you did, especially those that related to the grain trade. Great movement.
Yeah, well, when I started the railway, I started at the lowest job that the CP had at the time, was call boy. And I used to have to go to the bunkhouses and the to wake the fellas up to go to catch their trains out of Thunder Bay, east and west. I had to go and call them. We had some employees living in YMCA and that sort of thing. And in those days, we never had telephones. So we had to go knock on their door and wake them up and tell them to be at work at a certain time. Then I became a car checker, then a car crew clerk, and a chief clerk. And I worked my way into yardmaster position, which was basically the operating end of railway.
Sure. And your office was...
On Hardesty Street. We worked out of the little building there. They've ripped it down now at Hardesty and Bethune.
Right.
If you remember. And we went through some great times those days. Everything was, there was no diesels. It was all coal.
Right.
And a tremendous amount of trains carrying coal, and it was just amazing how busy we were. Well, diesel came in, and the early 50s with the passenger train, and then in that later on in the 50s, they went all diesel.
Yeah.
And that, of course, made the trains became longer. Grain trains, they went up to 100, 120 cars, that sort of thing. And again, in those days, every grain train that came into Thunder Bay had to be pumped. The cars had to be separated. Car of wheat for Pool 1, a car of wheat for Cargill, a car of wheat for Pool 7. It was all separated. And they operated that way right until the grain... Grain Transportation Agency, or Canadian Transport Commission at the time, took over, and in accordance with the Canadian Wheat Board, they changed the system to pooling, so that a car of grain, if it was car wheat, came into Thunder Bay, it could go to any elevator that handled wheat. And that eliminated all that individual humping and switching. So a whole train of wheat could go to any elevator. But then the companies that owned the grain in the first place or had taken the grain in, they wanted their share at Thunder Bay, so we had to develop a formula for each grain company. So SAS Wheat Pool was the largest. They handled about 50% of the grain in the country. Therefore, we had to give them 50% of the grain
in
Thunder Bay. Manitoba Pool was about 18%. Cargill was about 6 or 7%. Richardson was around 12%. Grain Growers was 15%. And P&H was about 1.5%.
Patterson's?
Patterson's wasn't part of it then. They had shut down all their elevators. In 1972, they didn't unload grain cars.
What were they moving? Had their elevators ceased operation here? They took it down in 84. I remember. Sorry, in 78 when I came to Thunder Bay, they were just knocking the elevator on the cab down.
Yeah. Well, they had shut down their operation. They were still in the transportation business, but only with their vessels.
They were buying grain on the prairies, the elevator. Yeah. My father, until, I don't really know what he did after 1960, probably still sold to Patterson's in Kelross, but up to that point, on the first farm, he bought a second farm, so I guess that, and I was off the university and so on, so I really not observed that. But he would have been selling to Patterson's, and I'm wondering then through the 50s. Well, they would have had their elevator in operation then, I guess.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
So how, if they were buying on the prairies but not operating an elevator here, then were they taking delivery of grain for the Patterson ships from other elevators?
They might have been. They might have made a deal with one of the grain companies.
It could
have been Cargill. It could have been Richardson's. It could have been UGG. As far as I can remember, they were only involved in shipping it out of Thunder Bay.
Yes,
and that was a different contract altogether. That was they were operating their vessels.
Yeah, and your concern, your focus was on movement to the port. Others were involved with organizing delivery, shipping from the elevators.
Right.
Say.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's an interesting sketch of activities. Did you work yourself with the organizing the humping, the separating of cars and so on?
When I worked at the railroad,
yes. Of
course, that was part of my responsibility, was the handling all the cars, not only grain, everything that arrived into Thunder Bay was handled by our department.
Right. So our very first interview was with Roy Lamour, who worked for... Was it CN? Oh, yes, that's right. It was CN because he was out in the Roslyn Yards, come to think of it. So he would have been
they used to hump the grain in Nebing.
Oh, yes.
And we used to hump our grain in Westport. But then it all changed.
Sure. Yeah. And that, of course, is where we begin to focus. The Canadian Transportation Commission was... a long-standing organization which had been in existence for some time when you came into it, I guess.
Yes, the Canadian Transport Commission was the regulatory authority for the railway. I think it's changed now. It's Transport Canada, I believe,
part of the department itself.
I suppose. But they don't... I don't think they have the same emphasis today that we had in those days. Canadian Transport Commission made sure the railways were operating safely and to some extent economically, and without the railways we couldn't move the grain. So
no, Well, the whole deregulation mania that began to develop in the 80s, I guess I remember with Ian worrying about the removal of the cabooses from trains, for example, and they began tying, fastening something rather of an electronic sort, is it, to the tail of the train so that it's supposed to warn them if anything goes wrong or whatever, but there aren't any people back there any longer. That happened sometime in the mid-80s, I think.
Well, they still had cabooses when I retired, and I was in 96, so they still had some of the. They were operating trains without cabooses. I personally didn't think that was ever going to work, but I guess it
No.
did.
And rail safety has had its low spots, low points, and otherwise, I guess the grade has moved. Well, let's focus then on the organization of things for the railway companies and the elevators. You've already mentioned the move to pooling, which that took place while you were
Yeah, pooling came into effect in 1972.
right at the time you began.
That's right. That was in conjunction with the opening of the Canadian Transport office in Thunder Bay, and it was entirely nobody knew how this was going to work. It was proposed. I remember the first meeting we went to. We had all the grain elevator superintendents were at the meeting, managers, and the Canadian Wheat Board employee made the presentation that effective so-and-so date everything was going to be pooled. And one of the managers said, "Well, what does that mean that my car of wheat, my good wheat, is going to go to Cargill and I'm going to get somebody else's?" The answer was, it's the luck of the draw. But as it turned out, it made the port tremendously more efficient. Everybody, I mean, whatever a grain elevator did prior to 1972, they tripled it after that, and the records indicate. We In 1 year, I think it was 83, 84, we handled over 19 million tons of grain through the Port of Thunder Bay. Now, the best they can do now is maybe 5 million.
It was a glorious era.
It sure
I was
was.
running in the summer of 84, and Frank Mazur, president of the Grain Handlers Union, had nominated me and so on, and he was very proud of the 1,800 guys up and down the waterfront of the elevators helping to handle that grain. So it's a dozen good years that followed on this decision. The companies previously had depended on supply from their elevators. Patterson's were outside this, but the elevator I know, of course, in Colrose, Manitoba, would presumably have been loading wheat that made its way to the Patterson elevator on the Kaministiquia, to use a maybe anachronistic example now. The quality of the grain, as you've suggested from one of the questions, would remain of concern always. Was there anyone from the Grain Commission at this meeting?
Oh
Because
yes, definitely.
it
Grain
was grading
Commission.
that would be very important.
The Grain Commission was there, but as it turned out, it really didn't. If you talk to an elevator manager, he will tell you, Ernie, the only way they can really make any money is to clean the grain, and so it w didn't matter if they had dirty grain or damp grain or whatever. They would clean it, and they would upgrade it. They could take a car, let's say, of one red 12.5, and by cleaning it, make it one red 11.5, and one 11.5 would receive more money per ton than 12.5 or 13.5 or whatever, and that's the way the system went. Now everybody, the way the grain would come out of the country, the Wheat Board would make an agreement to sell so many tons to, let's say, Italy.
Sure.
And so they would ship it out of the country from various grain elevators to Thunder Bay, and then when they had enough for a boatload or two boatloads, then that's the way it left Thunder Bay. Right. But it was cleaned here, and that's the way the grain elevators made their profit.
If, in terms of the service they charged for the cleaning?
What?
In terms of the fee that they charged for the cleaning service, or what else, how would they make their profit from that?
Okay, well, they could, they would get a fee or charge for cleaning the grain.
Yes.
But if they took, if they took, let's say, 1% of everything they handled, and could work that 1% through the rest of the system, they could make a lot of money. One year in Thunder Bay, SAS Wheat Pool paid the federal government $55 million in taxes, just SAS Wheat Pool alone. So then you could double that and say that the grain industry paid the federal government over $100 million of taxes that one year, plus the taxes that they paid to the city, almost a million each grain elevator. So the city had tremendous revenue from the grain elevators.
It certainly did, but yeah. But those are costs for the companies. And I understood you to be suggesting that the cleaning service was a source of profit for the companies.
Well, what I'm saying is if they were able to pay all these taxes, they were making the money to do it, is what I'm saying. They paid tremendous amount of taxes.
Sure.
And all related to the amount that they could handle through the port.
So I was wondering whether you were talking about dockage, but maybe that's the question that Owen wanted to ask.
No, you finish. I just had a question on the pool itself. But right. Go ahead.
Were you thinking of dockage as well, and what they pulled out in the process
well,
of cleaning?
Yes.
Because they could make money with that.
I don't know if anybody understands how the grain industry operated, but they could take dockage and put a little bit back into another boatload. They could have 1% dockage, and then they could add. I understand they even added a little water in now and then to make things a little heavier. But the final analysis was the inspection by the Canadian Grain Commission, and if they certified that there was 25,000 tons of 1 Red 13 on that boat, that's what was there.
And there was a vital service that existed for 100 years and is now gone from public employ as well, and the changes on the waterfront.
Yes.
You were going to ask a question
just
as well.
Just getting back to the pool system, a big change in the 70s, which you said really sharpened their pencils here in town. But whose idea was it? Did they borrow it from another country's grain system, or is that something that was developed in Canada?
The pooling system?
Yes.
My understanding was that it was something came right out of the Canadian Wheat Board. When the question was asked, why is all this grain coming and why are we sorting all this grain at Thunder Bay? Why can't all the elevators handle the same amount? And the question was, why not? The ownership was the big thing. Ownership was, as I said before,
yes.
They not only did they want their quality grain, they wanted their percentage of grain.
Of course.
So that's where our office came in.
Sure.
We had a pretty good system of accounting to make sure that each grain company received their share of grain.
Yeah.
Now, the only reason why a company wouldn't is if they didn't want to unload cars, or if they were full, then maybe they, because of their own inability to handle grain, they wouldn't. That's when they would lose their cars. But they always had the opportunity to make it up at a later date as well. That was in our agreements.
So, and they could sort of bank entitlements if they couldn't use them at the moment.
That's right, yes.
I guess to one further, maybe last question in regard to the base, the background for the pooling, Sask Pools Elevators, of course, would be in Saskatchewan. Did any issue of differences in the quality of the grain grown, let's say, in Saskatchewan as against in Manitoba or Alberta, was that raised by anyone that we're going to be getting a better quality of grain now if we get some of the Saskatchewan growing stuff, or was there no real difference?
No, I don't think there was, because the only problem they would have in the northern part of Saskatchewan and the northern part of Manitoba tended to have more of a tough and damp type of grain. But that was all resolved when the grain was handled at Thunder Bay, and they would put they would clean it, dry it if necessary, and put it up to the standard.
The elevators all had drying capacity.
Every elevator had drying capacity.
Harvesting when it's a little damp, tough as you say, is certainly one of the things that can happen. Say as a farm boy, when you decide when to start the combine in the morning, and how dry is the swath.
Yeah. And the drying capacity at Thunder Bay was an issue. We would find that if a grain company unloaded 16 hours a day, it would take 24 hours to clean that amount. So it didn't make sense to unload 24 hours a day.
Okay.
Because their drying capacity so would fall behind on that.
Two 8-hour shifts, and you've got enough grain to keep the equipment running through the night.
Right.
So would there be workers on it at night? Do
oh,
you
yeah,
know that?
Definitely. 12-day shift, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, too.
Yeah. It was a real process industry, wasn't it?
And then the other thing... I don't know if we're going to get into this, but by pooling the grain and working 6 days a week and 16-hour unload shifts, etc., the railway cars turned around much faster. And our turnaround time from a point equidistant in Saskatchewan,
sure,
to Thunder Bay was 14 days, complete turnaround. That same car going to Vancouver would be 29 days, because we were twice as efficient as Vancouver. Now, there was fundamental reasons for that.
Sure.
One of them was Vancouver didn't have the capacity we had.
No.
They didn't have 2 million ton capacity. But our turnaround was excellent. And that 14-day turnaround meant that the railways could get 2 trips a month instead of 1.
Sure.
Always amazed me why the railways themselves would have wanted to abolish the crow rate and the pooling system. They're not as efficient today as they were in the 70s and 80s.
And the move for that was underway by 1980, wasn't it? It's a little while now since I read the account of all of this, the work in the early 80s,
well,
to do away with the crow rate, but they were angling towards it in the last Trudeau ministry already.
It actually started in the late 80s, is when I was notified
when it really took effect.
That they were somewhere down the line they would be closing our office, and I retired in 96. And I think the office only operated another year and a half or two after that, and then they shut it down.
Yeah.
Mike Amos looked after things after I retired.
And we had the pleasure of interviewing Mike a little while ago.
Yeah.
The question of government, the ministry, what's his name? Jean-Luc Pépin was the minister in the early 80s, who was meeting with farmers and trying to persuade them, meeting with the pools, because it was first of all work on the prairies to persuade the farmers and the pool elevator companies to do away with to abandon the subsidy system, which the federal government didn't think they could afford it along for the long haul. It may have been the federal government that pushed most of all, more than the railway companies did.
That's quite possible. I seem to recall that the subsidy was somewhere around $600 million a year, and that the government wanted to get out of that.
Yeah, they certainly did.
The railways and the grain companies thought that it would be better if we went to a totally free market system, no pooling, and that's what they're doing now. They're cleaning the grain in the country. I don't know how they could be making profit like they would at. They don't have the elevator capacity in the country like they would at a port.
Well, they built all these inland terminals.
Yeah.
That was beginning in the 70s as well, was it not?
Well, there's you'll see in one of the documents that I gave you, the amount of elevators that we had in the 80s and then how it came down through the years.
Yeah.
I think when I left, there was... Well, maybe 1,200 elevators left in the prairies.
Yes.
I don't know how many they have today.
Oh, it'd be far fewer than
that.
Elm Creek was one of the first of those sort of inland terminals that Cargill built. Colorado was next to Elm Creek, and I went to high school at Elm Creek. And I think the first time I saw Cargill name on an elevator was in... But it was at Sintaluta in eastern Saskatchewan, which is where one of the great pioneers of the prairie farm movement lived. And as I said to my friend in the history department at the University of Saskatchewan, it was the first time in my life I was tempted to arson. It just seemed an abomination to have an American elevator in this particular town. I was tempted to burn the thing down.
Yeah.
But then to see one, and that was a regular one, and it's gone. I've looked around Sintaluta when I went by the place more recently. But they built this one, and then others have followed suit across the prairie. So at intervals, you see these much larger facilities, and I guess their primary use is cleaning and drying there.
But I think what you should do is talk to a former elevator manager and ask, did you remember Don Trost? He was the manager of... of Sasweet Pool. I remember him telling me they could never do in the country what they do at the ports.
Yeah.
Cleaning and drying.
Is he still with us?
He's still, I don't know where, he doesn't live in Thunder Bay anymore. Mm-hmm. He moved out of Thunder Bay. But there's other managers that are still in Thunder Bay.
Be interesting to find some people from the prairies who involved
to see
in these
what
terminals
doing there.
To see what their
yeah.
perspective is. And
yeah.
I don't know that we've actually found anyone. That's a fairly recent phenomenon. And our first intention, more or less main intention, has been to get people who are retired from the trade, such as yourself. But sometimes in these latter months, we should be thinking of people who are still in it, just because they're not yet retired is the reason why they can
yes.
be a resource for us. Well, so the pooling system comes in. Was this the time as well, or by this time, better put, were the hopper cars already in operation?
The hopper cars started in the 70s. They weren't all they weren't there in 72. They started later on, and I gave you the information.
Statistics.
Is in one of these here. The amount of hopper cars. That was another reason why we had to have the government involved in the car unloading process, because more than half the fleet was owned by the federal government. And, of course, the government owned 15,000 and the Weed Board 2,000 hopper cars. Alberta had 1,000 and Saskatchewan had 1,000. Now, Manitoba in those days decided to put their money into boxcars so that they could be handled to Churchill, because Churchill couldn't handle hopper cars. They oscillated on them, and they created operating problems.
On that rail line across the Muskeg.
Right.
Yeah.
So it was boxcars only to Churchill.
Right, so that's the better part of, what is that, 19,000 hopper cars?
Yeah, that's right.
Adding them up.
Yeah, 19,120 to be exact.
Were they all built in Nova Scotia, or did they come out of Hamilton?
I think they came out of
Hamilton,
and there might have even been a couple of other places too, because they came on awfully quick.
Well, I'm wondering whether it was part of Cape Breton development and so on and so forth, keeping the Dominion, the old Dosco facilities going there for a time, so that it was a kind of a federal make-work project.
I'm sure
15,000 is a lot of cars, isn't
that's
it?
Right.
I'm in the Canada yearbooks these days pursuing Canadian fiscal history, and I'm getting into the 60s, and I'll soon be in the 70s. I'm going to start have my eye open for subsidies for construction. I was noticing the amount being spent on transportation already in the Diefenbaker days. I don't know offhand now what those transportation expenditures went for. There's some millions of dollars, obviously.
I think the other another reason why they had to build the hopper cars, the railway said they weren't going to spend any money on equipment as long as the crow rate was in effect. So the government supplied the hopper cars.
So the hopper cars made the port much more efficient, too.
Sure did. Yes,
how
did
a hopper car compare with a boxcar in terms of capacity?
About a third more.
About
a third more.
And the trains could be longer?
And that's right. I mean, the trains, if they were 100-car trains, now you got at least 30% more grain in the train, in each train.
Without adding any cars.
That's right.
Yeah. And I suppose at this end, in terms of the facilities, the unloading at the elevators and so on, the hopper cars were more efficient as well. Did you notice then an increase in the flow through year by year? Although I guess that depends ultimately on what the wheat board has managed to sell.
The railway still, we had 19,000 hopper cars, but the railway still had an excess of 20,000 of the boxcars, so we had to handle both.
Right.
And one company, I won't mention, asked me one day if they just asked for hopper cars and no boxcars, what would be my response to that? And I said, you would only get your share of hopper cars based on your percentage in the country. So anybody that had a dumping facility maintained a dumping facility for boxcars.
For boxcars.
I think today there aren't any more boxcars. I haven't seen any boxcars with grain in them in the last 10 years.
So. Yeah. Well, it was quite a business, and from the time you started with the change in rolling stock and so on, were there changes in the way in which your work was carried on then after the wheat board got the pooling arrangements accepted by the elevator companies? Then were there changes over the next, you were there for about 14 years.
I was actually 24 years.
Yes, of course, 72 to 96. Yeah, yes, I'm dropping
24 years.
A decade in there.
A lot of things changed. When the pooling agreement required upgrading and manipulating things to make everybody more efficient. But in addition to that, we had to have what we call the proportionate car placement agreement with the two railways, because CP historically brought in 60% of the grain into Thunder Bay, but only handled 40% of the grain elevators, only serviced 40% of the grain elevators. Conversely, CN, they only brought in 40% of the grain. This was a base on a yearly basis because they went to Churchill as well. But they handled the exact figures was 57% of the grain elevator operation.
This was a matter of the location of the main lines and the elevators.
That's right.
Those were close to the CP main line.
Yes.
And so on.
And
so there had to be interchanges.
So we had to have an agreement between the railways that CN would place so many CP cars every week. And then not only that, furthermore, starting on Monday, instead of leaving them till Thursday and Friday, we had to have them agree to handle the cars starting on Monday, so that everybody would get a quick turnaround.
Sure.
And it made the port more efficient. Looked up some letters there from CP and CN officials saying that the best thing that ever happened was the grain coordinating office at Thunder Bay. It made them more efficient.
Sure.
And it also made the vessels more efficient. You know, there's lots of times when you'll see 5, 6, 8 ships sitting. That's not good. That means they're waiting for grain.
No, they may dress the bay. People may enjoy seeing them, but yeah, you're right. That's wasted time and money.
And some of them ships are $10,000 a day sitting idle. So if they sit there for a week, that's $70,000, 2 weeks. That's a lot of money.
From your knowledge, they have arrived as a result of a sale by the wheat board to whomever. The country presumably has chartered those ships to come here and pick up that grain. Why would the delay occur then? The grain wasn't here?
Grain wouldn't have been, they probably sold it before they had it transported and loaded in the country.
Yeah.
And they make a deal, or else the vessel could arrive a day or a week earlier than they anticipated, because ocean shipping is not like lake shipping. Lake shipping is predictable. Ocean shipping isn't.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's a question of where the ship is, I guess, and with radio and whatnot. They can
That's one of the reasons why they have trouble in Vancouver. Vancouver historically has barley in the elevators and ships waiting for wheat, and vice versa. They'll have wheat in the elevators and ships waiting for barley, because they don't have the storage, and they don't have a specific arrival time for the ocean shipping.
Yeah. So we had, when you said 2 million tons capacity earlier, that's what all the elevators could hold if they were full, eh?
Right.
And so that's for a 12 million ton season, that's six fills and empties, is it? It operates over a longer period of time, of course, but...
Well, we always measured elevator efficiency on the basis of their turnover ratio.
Sure.
And if we had 2 million tons of storage and we handled 19 million tons, that's 9.5 times turnover ratio. Now, if you go to any elevator in America, they'd be lucky to turn themselves over twice.
In a season.
And they have a big elevator in Hutchinson, Kansas. I think it has almost 1 million tons capacity, that one elevator.
On the Mississippi, I suppose?
Yes. I have never been to Hutchinson, but I would suspect that it's got to be on the Mississippi.
Check the map when I go home.
Yeah. But anyways, they handle maybe 2 million tons of grain there.
So there's a lot of time with the bins are either empty or they're full, and there's no boat, no barge available to move this stuff. Eh? Well, the Lakehead obviously was designed to move things quickly. The exchange between the two railways, was there one particular point where they'd shunt them over from their line to the other company's line, or are there a number of places where they could do that here?
There were three places where they interchanged at the port: the Mission area, the Intercity area, and Kern River.
Okay.
And It wasn't complicated as long as everybody knew ahead of time what had to be done.
And the companies were pleased. I suppose they might not have liked the way I'm going to put it now, but they were pleased that someone had imposed this kind of order on them or persuaded them to undertake this kind of operation.
Exactly. You know, I remember going to Duluth and interviewing some of the managers there, and their system was entirely different again because they don't pool their grain. And I asked one manager, I said, do you know how many cars you're going to get, railway cars next week? He says, no. And I said, do you know how many trucks you're going to get? He says, no. Well, that wasn't the case in Thunder Bay. We could tell the grain elevators exactly how many cars they're going to get in the subsequent week, so they could govern themselves accordingly for staffing.
This is the point at which we might celebrate the system that developed and prevailed for decades, for in which I suppose the wheat board was quite central, because the companies owned the elevators. They took delivery from the farmers, but the farmers were actually delivering to the wheat board, weren't they?
Exactly.
And the wheat board then had an overall picture of what was coming in. They knew how much they had. On the selling side, they were making the contracts with the buyers in other countries, and they were involved in organizing all of that system.
Exactly.
I should let you expand on that because it's all gone.
The wheat board was the kingpin in all of this. I mean, and as you said, they would, first of all, they knew how much grain was going to come out of the country. Mm-hmm. Then they would sell it. And then when they sold it, they'd have estimated times in the, and most of the selling was out of the St. Lawrence, not out of Thunder Bay. That's why we had our Lakers.
Yes.
So our Lakers would take the grain to Baie-Comeau, Port-Cartier, Montreal, and the grain was shipped into Salties from those big elevators there.
Would you have any comment on, from your observations of the arrival of Salties here rather than they're taking delivery in Montreal or downriver, down the St. Lawrence? Why were some of them here?
Well, most of the Salties, when I worked, when they came here, wasn't for wheat and barley. It was for the specialized grain, rapeseed, oats, that was not marketed by the Canadian Wheat Board. Yeah. That was the only thing the Wheat Board marketed was wheat and barley.
Right. And that was all you were involved with as well, I guess, then. Or did you manage all of the cars, everything flowing in?
Well, we managed that as well because that became part of their percentage. If they handled 6% of the grain in the country, that would include their rapeseed and oats and other commodities. Right. So we made sure they got 6% of the grain. They would get their... we didn't pool their grain. So... The rapeseed that belonged to Cargill, they loaded it in up at their elevator and so on.
Sure. So the humping would have to allow for the fact that some of those were specialized.
They didn't hump anymore. They would have to switch it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so as far as the cars were concerned, then were they digitally marked each of the cars? I presume there was something on every one of the cars that had the history of the grain.
Every car had a list of the car number, the weight, and the contents. And it would say wheat, one northern, or whatever.
Right. These were the initial gradings at the delivery points, I guess, by the
That's right. When it comes out of the elevator, they grade it there.
Did it indicate from whose elevator it came, or was that no longer part of the system then? This wasn't from a Richardson's, you know, Pioneer grain from wherever. That wasn't part of what was on the car, right?
Well, I think the origin point was on the car, but it didn't make any difference when it came here.
When it got here.
One Once the car arrived, it became part of the pool.
If it were a specialty car,
then
how were the cars separated? Was there an automated reader of them as the cars rolled by, or was it done manually? Well, someone on foot walking along?
The way they would pick them up in the country, let's say they loaded six cars, so they'd be six Cargill cars of rapeseed would be in a block.
Okay.
So they would either be in the head of the train or the end of the train, and it was relatively easy because what the railways would do, if we had to move 50 cars to the mission, they would take the six rapeseed and 44 wheat or sure. others.
Yes.
So it eliminated switching. Pooling was an amazing aspect of railway operations.
Yes.
It really was.
And the marvelous thing about it is that this had to be based on a kind of a uniformity in the product. The wheat had to be reasonably similar. I suppose farmers were growing the same variety of
wheat board would put out a document each week telling the farmer what to deliver and how much they were going to get per bushel.
Okay.
And that basically was the rule of the land.
Yeah, and farmers with any size of operation would have some idea and would respond.
That's right. Like a farmer wasn't able just to load anything he wanted and bring it to an elevator. There would be times when the grain elevator would say, we're not accepting that.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I hardly remember my father's decision-making. He may well have telephoned the agent at the Patterson Elevator and asked whether he could bring something in. I guess it would come down to that. They'd have to
exactly,
do that
because
kind of checking. This, of course, is a long time ago, back through the 50s that I'm thinking of from my own observations.
But once pooling came into effect, the system had to, there was no use bringing barley into the system when the wheat board was looking for wheat.
No, I dare say.
I have to tell you, Ernie, I have no idea how they're operating now. I can just...
No, I've...
It's all individual company and...
I'll say something about that after this interview. I'm trying to get some information. I won't put it on the card, but... Yes, Owen, a question about this?
No, just an update. Hutchison is the largest, longest grain elevator in the world.
Which one?
Hutchison.
Yes, it's over a mile long.
Yeah, and built in 1961... Cargill has an interest in there because of the salt mines in that area as well.
Salt mines.
And it's on the Arkansas River. It's just north of Wichita.
Well, I was thinking to myself, I don't know my geography well enough to say that the Kansas reaches the Mississippi. I rather thought not,
that's
actually.
Yeah,
that's it. Incident information.
I always wanted to go there. I've been in Wichita. And it's about an hour drive away from Wichita, I think, and I never got around to it. But it is a huge facility.
Yeah, I've been through Topeka, Kansas, I think. I think through the corner of Kansas, driving south, actually, a long time ago. This would be further south then. So the Arkansas is it wouldn't be that large a tributary, I would think, of the Mississippi. That may be one of the problems, too, that the barges are of limited capacity that can carry grain down. But it would allow...
But they would truck to the Mississippi.
Oh, I see.
They could do that, too,
which
wouldn't be that far.
In the era of climate change and carbon economy concerns, I wonder how much it will change in the grain industry. Well, I'm thinking that a typical day is probably... Was there a typical day in your in the job?
A typical day? I think every day was different, but ended up, you could say, being the same. If we were going to unload 1,000 cars, there was always two or three different issues to contend with.
Yeah.
In retrospect, it was very, very efficient.
How large was the office? Was your office? How many people?
Four.
And each of you, and you were.
I was the.
You became the manager, the head.
I was the manager, and I had an assistant, and I had two girls working.
Okay.
And
how much was there? A lot of paperwork, record keeping in your. I guess there would have been.
We kept track of all the car unloading, everything that left the port as well. All the shipping information was, we recorded that. Daily unloads, weekly unloads, monthly unloads.
Which is
formulas similar. For everything.
Yes. Digitized in computers or
we,
paper records?
No, we had, we went into computers. The girls would say this computer didn't have enough gigabytes, and we had to
capacity.
Upgrade every 3 or 4 years. We had to get new computers and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But no, it ran very efficiently considering only four people. And they had the same amount in Vancouver.
5 days a week?
We operated 6 days a week. What we did, I had Saturday and Sunday off. My assistant had Sunday and Monday off,
sure.
So he would work Saturday,
yes.
And one of the girls as well.
And you were you actually under the authority of a piece of legislation? Was there a grain transportation?
Yes, there was
Act,
legislation.
Agency Act.
Yeah, we worked for the Minister of Transport.
You put the Transport Canada.
Report to him.
And so that gave you the authority then that was necessary. Companies all accepted the fact that you'd been created by legislation and you
That's
were
right.
there doing the job. And it was, when would the act have been passed? Sometime in the early 70s?
Well,
mid-70s?
The original Canadian Transport Commission introduced the Menzies in 1972, I don't think it was an act of Parliament was even necessary. The railways had the authority
okay, so
to
it
do
would have
the
been under the commission
right.
then, or the department.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it all changed when it went to the Grain Transportation Agency. And originally, the Grain Transportation Agency was established in Winnipeg, and it was. Maybe 2 years later that they convinced the government to transfer our office to them and then have everything under
so,
the one
So
roof.
You came under the
under
central
the,
office.
That's right. And then we ended up working for Thompson. I don't know if you remember him. His name was Thompson.
Not the minister.
No. He was just... they appointed him to the Green Transportation Agency. He was a friend of Mazankowski. He went to school with Mazankowski.
In the 80s.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I don't think I had the good fortune to meet Mr. Thompson. I did visit the Wheat Board once in the mid-80s, an interesting experience. Well, there are opportunities for you to tell us, for example, what would you like people to know about the work that you did and the... in this office here.
Well, I always kid my friends that I always thought I was grossly underpaid when I think back at the amount of grain that went through Thunder Bay I'm just kidding.
Tell you a story. There's this story about a farm leader who's visiting Winnipeg 100 years ago, and he's being driven along Wellington Crescent. And as he sees the mansions of the grain merchants, he begins to mutter under his breath, you know, one cent a bushel. They did all of, they got all of this
exactly.
out of one cent a bushel.
Yeah.
Now, if you'd been paid 1 cent a bushel.
I would have been all right.
You would indeed.
But it was an interesting job. I always told my friends and relatives I had the best job in the world. And it was interesting. It was, and you had... you had to like mathematics.
Numbers.
And the girls that worked for us had to have that aptitude to be able to handle numbers.
I was thinking you should have been a baseball statistician.
Yeah.
Yeah, I dare say they would have to enjoy numbers because they were
That's
entering
right.
them, inputting
yeah.
them after a while,
yeah.
and that takes care as well, transposing numbers.
And it was interesting. I was fortunate enough to be. I had the kind of people that I worked for that promoted the idea to travel and see. I went down the St. Lawrence Seaway three times.
On a ship?
On the Lakers.
Yeah.
I went to every grain elevator on the St. Lawrence. We went to Baie-Comeau. We took a trip out of here to grain, to Baie-Comeau, then to Port Cartier for a load of iron ore over to Chicago and back to Thunder Bay in 17 days. Now, I don't know how you could get more efficient than that.
Yeah.
And to see the way they can unload a Laker faster than we can load it, if you believe. They have these huge, huge vacuum cleaners that go right in and it just suck the grain up into there faster. They could unload a 25,000 ton ship quicker than we could load it.
Really?
Yeah.
What do they call those things? I've seen pictures or heard.
All they are is big vacuum cleaners. Yeah. And then they put a little front end loader to clean up the end, and they wash it all out. And
yes.
There it comes back.
But you've been on the ship. That's an interesting point. If the ship has carried iron ore to Chicago or Indiana port, whatever it may be, it has to be cleaned out before you could put grain in it, I presume.
Right. It would be washed out.
It'd be washed out again.
Yes. We unload the iron ore and clean it out. And the water is hot, too, because it's the water they use to generate their system.
Strictly water.
Yeah.
And the water, it would be dumped or would it remain on the ship?
When they cleaned it,
they would just
dump it.
Into the harbor or whatever.
Yeah. All it would be is
a certain amount of iron or dust or dust, rock.
Right.
Rocky dust would be in there. Because I've wondered about that, using a ship, a bulk carrier, to move. I guess oil could be moved as well. Although that would be trickier, I think, cleaning it.
Yeah, it was mostly iron ore.
Would have shut us down to remove it. No, it's already
no,
been grabbed. Good. Yes,
that was, as I said, extremely important to understand what a vessel had to go through.
Yes.
Through all the locks. It's all in one of the pages that I gave you there too, Ernie. That's very interesting. All done with gravity. The whole St. Lawrence Seaway system is gravity. It's amazing.
It's a joy to watch locks at work because of the gravity based flows of water, isn't it?
And then another thing I would, my boss would say, how are things going in Thunder Bay? Good. What about Duluth? What are they doing there? I'd say, I don't know. Well, why don't you take a trip and go and see what's going on over there? And that's what I did. And so by doing this, you could see that what they did wrong and what we were doing right, it just magnified the my understanding of the system.
So we wait for a moment or celebrate this part as well. One could think of the American system as exemplifying private enterprise, competition between companies, and so on. In the Canadian case, they're really, by the, say, 1980, with the well-established system, there really wasn't any kind of competition left, but it was all the efficiency of the railways. Each had its network of lines and elevators. They were bringing it in and sharing appropriately. And the grain companies were all working for the Grain Commission, in effect, in terms of providing the services. Everything is organized here. And the end result is a system that is just incredibly efficient.
Absolutely.
Low cost and so on and so forth. You have any comments on cost factors? That would not be something you'd be as familiar with because you had an office of people, a few people who were organizing all of this. Others were bearing the costs or saving the money because of the efficiency.
There was a few times when somebody would say it's more costly to move grain out of Thunder Bay because of the having to handle it twice, whereas when a grain went to Vancouver, it would go into the elevator and then into the salty. In going east, it had to go to Thunder Bay into an elevator in the St. Lawrence and then into the Salty. But when you took in all the factors of how much grain we moved and the short turnarounds, it was, and the mileage. I mean, we're talking 1,200 miles to Montreal and Baie-Comeau for it, to do that by rail, if we had a rail at all there. When you consider that we were more efficient.
Sure. Well, you're doing it in a sense, as far as the rolling stock is concerned, for half the cost. If you're getting double the turnaround, the delivery out of the fleet, you're saving a vast amount of money. In the winter, there was a certain amount of railing to the St. Lawrence. Were you involved with that?
Yes, but it all had to come here first, and the grain had to be cleaned. It was loaded here.
Okay.
They tried a couple of trains direct out of the country.
Northern Sea and line, I suppose, Winnipeg to Quebec City, perhaps?
Quebec City was the only one that really could handle hopper cars. And there was no rail facilities to Baie-Comeau or Port-Cartier. Quebec City and Montreal was the only ones that unloaded.
Right. Well, let's. What might interest or surprise people? I think you may have been on the brink of that with these last comments about, in terms of what you'd like people to know. But what might surprise people about what you were doing?
Well, I really don't know how to answer that. The one thing that's always puzzled me is that. Industry thinks that government regulation is no good. Yeah. And I think that our office helped industry, made industry more efficient, made all the private industry more efficient, and certainly they would welcome government involvement. Like I think that if you talk to some of the managers, they still would say they would rather that they operate their elevator on their own and not have government involved, and that always just puzzled me to no end.
You ran into people that were saying that.
Absolutely,
including Jim Simpson.
Well, Jim Simpson would have liked to seen our office closed. But
I should explain, of course, Jim managed the Richardson facility and ran against me in '84 as the conservative candidate. So,
but
so Jim Richardson would have been happy to have been running their own Pioneer grade through the terminals.
But on the other hand, Don Trost, who ran Sweetpool. If you asked him, he would say that nothing better than our office because we could tell them what to do in the following weeks.
Yes. Well, you indicated the business they were going to have, and he was happy to have that information.
That's right.
So this would relate all the way through to scheduling of work, wouldn't it, whether to call guys in or conceivably... would there have been short-term layoffs if it was a slow week, or did they have them puttering around waiting for the...
Once navigation started, Ernie, there was no slow weeks. Yeah. As a matter of fact, we always could have done a little bit more, you know? There was always that 10% buffer there. We could have, if we had an extra ship, or an extra shift, we could have done a little bit more all the time.
So the season would begin when already in late August. I'm thinking of the crop ripening and the grain beginning to move, or is it into September that it really?
No, it moved in August. Late August is when it, and the wheat board year was August 1st to July 31st.
Sure.
Yeah.
And it would be. And it would run certainly through December, would it then? Was it busy all the way through?
Right till Christmas, December.
Till the port shut down for the winter.
That's right. And there was years when they loaded chips and they stayed here loaded, you know.
Sure. Yeah. Did you have any dealings with Frank Mazur or with the...
Oh, yes. Frank and I, we had lots to do with Frank. He was a supporter of our office. And again, because we could... By being associated with the Canadian Wheat Board the way we were, they were obligated to tell us not only what their short-term plans were, what their long-term plans were. So we could tell a grain elevator it's going to be a busy year, it's going to be a bad year, or whatever, based on the information that the Wheat Board would supply us with.
This would be ultimately the quality, the kind of year that farmers were having.
That's right, and based on what the surplus, there was always a surplus. Canada the average production in a year in Canada would be about 55 million tons, and of that 55 million, 15 to 20 million was always kept for domestic use. And then that meant that there was 30 million or so, 35 million to export.
And this is wheat?
Wheat and barley.
Wheat and barley.
Yeah. And all grains.
Okay, it's a total for all grains.
And Thunder Bay would handle 18, 19 million. The West Coast would handle 15 million, and the rest would be, some of it went into America by truck and that sort of thing.
Sure.
But now if there was a surplus, the Wheat Board would know where it is and what it is.
Yes.
And then they would know what's coming. So they'd say, well, it looks like we're going to have a heavy wheat movement this year.
Yeah. The domestic use of wheat would involve the milling of flour, I guess, first of all. Did that industry, do you know much about the flour milling industries through the years of your employment?
Not too much. Whatever, they didn't do too much of that here. They did a lot of it in Winnipeg.
There was quite a bit of flour.
Yeah.
I remember in the 50s when the market for wheat wasn't so good for a time, the mill in Winnipeg was taking delivery of wheat from farmers and handing them the flour in return. There must have been a bit of a charge for it, because obviously
I would think milling, so. But
so they will have taken a certain quantity of wheat, would buy you a certain amount of flour. But I remember my father's doing a little bit of that business with one of the flour mills in the city.
And then on the other side, the barley was handled, the malting barley was handled at Canada Malt.
Yes.
And that, of course, was all done separately. We didn't pool their grain. No. Their grain went to their elevator.
Yeah, I really have no feel. My father just didn't grow barley, other than for feed purposes, malting barley. But there were farmers, I guess, who did specialize in that. I don't know whether he did it because of a temperance attitude, you know. He wasn't going to be involved in the production of beer. No. That's quite possible. He's gone, so I can't ask him why he wouldn't grow malting barley, but... there were others who obviously were happy to achieve that grade of barley, because it does require a certain quality, doesn't it? Well, I hardly need to ask you what you're most proud of in your work, but if you wanted to put it in some focused words, that's another of the questions
in
this questionnaire.
Well, only that I know that I that I was part and parcel of the largest grain port in the world.
Yeah, and the next question is about whether you contributed to Canada's international grain trade. Yes, sir.
It always it's interesting now when I see what the port is doing in the last couple of years, and they're pretty proud of it. But it's nowhere near what we used to do. You know, 5-6 million tons, and that would have been an ultimate disaster.
You wouldn't have been proud
80s.
Of that.
Yeah, but the other thing that I always try to relate to. I for some reason, our city never seemed to understand the importance of the grain industry in Thunder Bay. The city should have supported the Canadian Wheat Board and the pooling system, and they should have been doing things to try to keep it instead of ignoring it.
Why do you think that was? Because I would add to what you've just said, I got to know a woman who worked on the boat, so she was did some work in history at the university, so it was a kind of academic knowledge of her. But she became a mate on a ship and so on, part of the crew, officer of the ship. And she was quite pointed about that she didn't think that the people of Thunder Bay appreciated the fact that they had a port. Now, why is that?
That is a good question. I remember Mayor Hamilton. Do you remember?
David Hamilton.
David?
Oh, yes.
And they were having an issue with the grain companies. They wanted to have their taxes reduced.
The companies?
The companies, yeah. Like $1 million, $1.5 million per elevator was three times higher than Duluth and twice as much as Vancouver. And I asked David, and he said, well, tell them to appeal it. Well, So the appeal process in those days didn't work too well on their behalf. So what happened? They end up closing an elevator. They sell it for a dollar to somebody who doesn't pay the taxes. Then the city is responsible for demolishing it. I don't understand why they didn't see this coming and taking the necessary stance on trying to keep the grain industry going in Thunder Bay.
Would you have any comment on the contrast let's say, the forest and the mills? Do you think the city was sensitive to the needs of the paper mills in the city? Or is there just sort of some overall unwillingness to appreciate the importance of what mills the city?
I'll put it this way. We're having quite a debate right now about the new complex that they might build.
And
it's $100 million or whatever. And, of course, who's going to pay for it? And the government, the federal government, provincial government, and the Canadian or the Thunder Bay taxpayer. Now, had we had those elevators still paying there, this wouldn't even be an issue.
No, I suppose not.
And certainly I don't understand where that all fell down, Ernie. If we had it to do all over again, I would think that they could do a much better job supporting the grain industry and the paper mills, too. They're all dead.
Yes, they certainly are. Through the years of your involvement, your professional involvement, if you will, was anyone from the grain trade involved with local municipal politics at all? I mean, Jim ran against me in '84, so he was a federal party candidate, so that would be one instance. Were there others, say, on the municipal scene particularly, were there people from the grain trade involved in municipal politics? Because they could certainly...
McKinnon might have known, but that'd be later on, eh?
Yeah, Brian McKinnon.
Brian
McKinnon. He came out of education.
Yeah, but
his family did.
Yeah.
I guess we could go checking to see who they were, but you don't. No one comes to mind
Certainly not.
Lawrence Tipco came out of the paper industry, right?
Right.
He was at Great Lakes?
Yeah, Great Lakes. Lawrence was Great Lakes.
So that could be part of it, but it makes one wonder what the city does know. What is important to the city? Sports, obviously. None of the sports teams, I guess, by your time was sponsored by any industry. They had been back in the 30s, I guess, from what Joe Greaves told me once upon a time. But Anyway, well, let's press on here. I won't ask about the connections you see between your work and the work of farmers growing the grain handled in the grain trade. Question: there are questions that have become rhetorical. We've talked to some extent about major changes. Would it be worth sort of listing the changes that you saw over the years in the grain trade and your involvement with it? We've recognized the changes in rolling stock and the efficiency, the creation of the function, the pooling that resulted, and so on and so forth. Would there be changes later on that, before the demise of the office?
No, really we were handcuffed in Thunder Bay because the limitations of the St. Lawrence Seaway to 25,000 ton ships. And the only thing that I think would have increased was making the seaway larger to accommodate the Panamax vessels.
The Eisenhower locks, I guess, handle that size, do they?
No.
The American siders, are they not that large?
There's a 1,000-foot lock at Sault Ste. Marie. And that's the largest. There's everything else is 750 feet.
Was my memory.
25,000. But had they made the St. Lawrence Seaway larger, Thunder Bay would be Chicago today. You know, it'd be
the
Salties, 100,000 ton ships. I've seen 125,000 ton ships in Baie-Comeau, five times bigger than our Lakers, Ernie. It's amazing. And
how long would they be?
They weren't that much longer, but they were wider.
Deeper, I
and deeper, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And amazing how large they were.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty clear that the St. Lawrence Seaway will never be upgraded, I
no,
suppose.
No, I wouldn't think so. The railways wouldn't want that. You'd have to, you know, there's a lot of business in Montreal now that would be bypassed if the St. Lawrence Sea was expanded.
Yeah.
No, I guess you're right. We'll never see it.
Have what we're, I guess, did we celebrate the 50th anniversary? The completion, I guess we did, that was a little while ago. We're well on the seaway was opened, was it 1959?
1759.
It's somewhere in that era, the late 50s. So I guess we're into the 65 years?
It's getting up there.
No, it was 55.
55.
Yeah. Well,
some of the new ships now that they're building, they can go on the ocean as well as the lakes, and they do carry a little more too. I think I read in the paper and saw a ship took 30,000 tons out of here the other day. That we never went over 25,000 tons.
Okay, so floated through the locks with great care, I suppose. I wonder, a different configuration of ship that would make it possible.
I can only assume that the whole system is a couple of feet higher. The water is higher now than it was 10 years ago.
It is depth to sill, isn't it? That is the determinant. Well, if we were to think about the challenges that you've faced on the job as against changes, would there be ones that you particularly want to focus? The desire of the company's preference to do it their own way if they could was not really a challenge. Did you have effective leadership from Ottawa or through the Department of Transport over the years?
I'd have to say that Ottawa always viewed Thunder Bay as kind of a small time operation. You know, I had a lot of problems convincing people in Ottawa that Thunder Bay was the largest port in North America, and I'd have to say that some of the bosses that I worked for in Ottawa, when they came here and saw the operation, and they understood how important Thunder Bay was to the whole scheme of.
Was Crosby John Crosby Minister of Transport?
I don't remember him as Minister of Transport.
He was here for the spring, Transportation Week in the spring once, but I don't think that. Was Mazankowski Minister of Transport?
Yes, he was. Mazankowski was Minister of Transport. And that's when he promoted Thompson.
And he visited here, I suppose, did he? Did you see Don Mazankowski here in the city? Did he ever make a visit?
I think he did. He didn't come to my
He didn't see your
office.
I don't suppose you ever saw Doug Young in the mid-90s in the Chrétien government.
I had a diary where I had everybody sign when they came to the office, and I'm sure that our prime minister came to our office long before he ever got involved in the leadership of the
Stephen Harper.
Stephen Harper, yeah. But if he was here, he never signed the book.
No.
I looked through that book religiously, and I was sure that he was here, asking questions on behalf of. I think Harper is one of the individuals that didn't want the Canadian Wheat Board.
Well, no. Thanks to a church involvement, I happened to become aware of something or other that Inky Marks, who'd been the Conservative MP for the Selkirk Interlake riding north of Winnipeg, wrote in the Free Press, in which he suggested that Stephen Harper was killing the family farm by the policies he was pursuing. And actually, that's one of the leads I'm trying to pursue at the moment. It's been a week of dead silence. I'll mention that after the machine shuts down. But that's an interesting query, that. So I wonder if Canadians are, beyond the city of Thunder Bay, tend to take a lot of economic activity in the country for granted. They don't involve themselves very much with it. And one of the ways the historian can try to appreciate some of this is to take those old Canada yearbooks, not the big fat statistical one, but the smaller one, and go looking at the pictures. And it happens, I was flipping through one, which was the big statistical one, the other day, and there was this lovely aerial shot of a prairie town, or hamlet really, but there were probably five elevators lined up along the railway track in the beautiful fields of grain. And the picture is meant to illustrate the survey pattern on the prairies, wild square sections and so on and so forth, and they are very well illustrated. But I saw the hamlet in the center with the elevators, thought to myself, now which Saskatchewan community is that, presumably on the CPR main line? And so we have the Statistics Canada and the National Film Board and so on doing their bit, but Canadians may take too much of this for granted. These days, of course, mining would be the question. The media work hard to convince us how important mining is, as of course it certainly is. As far as challenges the industry faced over the years, and we might think a little bit, things have changed so dramatically over these last years, and would you want to put your finger on what provoked the very series of changes? Would it be federal government actions, the end of the crow rate, federal government withdrawal from support for, well, they changed the way in which they supported the grain trade, I guess, with payments to farmers or whatever, and trying to focus the use of the grain on the prairies rather than supporting the export industry was really one of the things that went on.
Well, I think it was all related to the budget, and everything is that $600 million farmer subsidy, transportation subsidy. I guess they thought they would they could eliminate that and still have the same amount of throughput. But Then again, when you try to understand how complicated the grain industry is, Sass Wheat Pool at one time had 90 different commodities in their elevator. 90.
You're kidding.
Yes.
Kinds of grains? Grains.
But separated, yes, grades.
Grades.
You get one red 12.5. One red 13, one red 14, one 14.5. Then it had tough and damp. Then you go through all the barleys and the oats and the rye and you had to have a separate bin. You can't put damp grain in with dry and that sort of thing. So you had to have it. And we had 91 different commodities since that's Sass Wheat Pool 7. Now, when I look at how could they be sorting all this out in the country? Yeah. And how can they do that? How can they get a trainload of one red 12.5? How long does it take them to get 100 cars of one particular grain? One particular grade. It seemed to me like it's almost impossible.
Do you think that behind a certain amount of the change was a lack of appreciation for those distinctions? And the distinctions were what in terms of the related to milling? So when you say 13, 14, and so on, what does the number in each case allude to? It's what's in the grain, right?
The protein.
It's the protein content of the grain.
Yeah.
Do you think that there are people in Ottawa who thought that that was far too finely graduated, just forget about all of that?
Well, that's a good question, Ernie. That would have to be related to sales. How are you going to be able to sell a variety of grain or...
So the Wheat Board prided itself on being able to sell sight unseen. They didn't need to offer a sample. If the customer was told it was one of those, they knew exactly what they were getting in terms of the grain. And I gather that plant breeding in Canada, the varieties also involved the characteristic of the appearance of it. You were able to recognize what it was just at a glance. Every kernel had to be the same and so on and so forth. And I wonder whether they just didn't give a damn about that whole system. Because if you don't think it's important, then the Grain Commission ceases to be all that important, this careful grading. If you think you can persuade customers, if you can still sell the stuff on a much coarser system, then you can do away with an awful lot. And there must have been some such conviction in there, because they wouldn't be out to destroy an industry if they really believed that these gradations were important.
Well, I think, too, you'd have to say, where is this coming from? I remember the first time I met Mr. Thompson. I picked him up at the airport. And he says, where's the coal terminal here? He says, I want to go see the coal terminal. I says, why would you want to go see the coal terminal? He says, well, they got loop unloading. He says, maybe we should be doing grain like that. And there's that concept there. I still hear people talking that way. It was somebody said it last week that they're going to have loop tracks, so that they don't have to switch in and out, and the train just goes and loads that.
The ship direct.
Right. Yeah. And you see, that system, and that applies real well to coal.
Yes. Potash, I suppose.
Yeah, where you got one producer, one purchaser, one grade, maybe two grades. I don't know whether there's potash grades or coal grades, but it certainly doesn't have to be processed like wheat and barley.
What about canola? Were there gradations as well in canola?
I'm sure there was just canola as far as I was concerned, but I'm sure there were grades of canola at the grain elevators. They would know. But I guess that's the thing, Ernie. If you want to streamline something, you have to get rid of all these different entities.
Yes.
So instead of having 12-5, 13-5, just have one grade, one 13, period.
Yeah. So it's sort of anecdotally, one stumbles on things occasionally. Our son in Winnipeg at one point was looking for a job, and he ended up being hired by, I think it's a Swiss-based company, a European company that is in grading around the globe. And so he had the job for a little while of visiting farmers to grade grain right on the farm. And of course, some of them were a bit suspicious about what this was, and he was on contract, I think, through the company from the wheat board, or so he understood. But all kinds of things, and that surely wasn't efficient or cheaper to have these guys running around, especially when the people organizing the business did not have a sense of Manitoba geography. So they'd be sending someone to farms here, and then the next farms were hither and yon. And Bryce, of course, knowing something of Manitoba, set to work to organize it so there was more efficient. You could visit more farms because they were contiguous or closer to each other than the girls, if you will, in the office in Winnipeg, I think it was, who had no idea of Manitoba geography. But if you apply some kind of overall... these are questions really more for the future than the past, obviously, but I muse over them as I look at what surely is the disaster that's been done to the Canadian grain industry over the last few years. How these challenges will be met for the future, Lord only knows. Your most vivid memories of the job?
The most vivid memories of the job was when we broke previous records, when we handled in the port almost 10,000 unloads 1 week. 10,000 unloads. That's it was 97-62, I think.
How did you celebrate?
Well, going out for supper with the boys, some of the grain elevator managers and that sort of thing.
So you had a little informal dinner to celebrate.
We would do things like that, yes. Yeah. And the weekly records was one thing, but the other record, 1 year, 19.4 million tons, Ernie. That was another historical date. I don't think, can you imagine handling 19 million tons today? Be impossible. Yeah. That was my memories of
the ultimate achievements, the efficiency, yeah. The effectiveness of the work that you were doing. Yeah. And the most important events, I'm sure it's a period of very important work that you were doing, and which made me so very pleased to be able to sit down with you and remember those achievements and go back to all of that. Are there any questions that we haven't asked that you would like to answer?
Just that if further to all of this, you should be interviewing, I think, a past managers, grain managers, and there's still some around, and I don't know if you're able to go to Winnipeg to.
Well,
meet
I will
with
be in a couple of
there.
Weeks' time, and Nancy Peroso, my partner in this project, Owen's sister, as it happens, has done quite a bit of interviewing on the prairies. And I was just saying to Owen coming in that I needed to get all of that together.
Yeah.
While I'm in Winnipeg, perhaps, and holidaying with family, to lay it out carefully.
Well,
see
you should.
We've
you
seen
should
from every
with
sector.
The wheat board. There's the Canadian Wheat Board is still operating now, and they bought a grain elevator and they bought a ship and get their perspective on it.
Yeah. For the future. And Nancy has talked to wheat board people from the past, I know.
Yeah.
But certainly, because we are entering into a decidedly different era, talking to people about the present with an eye to the future is advisable too, I think, and I was beginning to think about that in a number of different places. No questions? Oh, did anything you've asked, questions you've had? Well, the next question is about memorabilia. I don't usually pursue people, but you've already laid some very interesting pieces of information on the table for us to carry off.
Yeah.
We'll do that with pleasure. I don't suppose I need to ask you whether you think it's a good idea for us to pursue this Voices of the Grain Trade project in terms of history.
Well, you're asking, should you continue it? Absolutely.
Yeah, I didn't really think I needed to ask you whether you thought it was important to remember the history that we've had over the years. And it's been a lot of change, actually, over the century more that it's operated. I was beginning to sort of rough out an outline history, because it takes detailed research, but one could do an outline, and I don't remember now, did I have as many as 17 or 18 chapters, because there's successive phases, the war years, first, second, and so on and so forth, private ownership and so on and whatnot, and then the pools and all the rest of it. And just surveying that, I think, in a little booklet, perhaps, would be a guide for others then to fit these interviews, these narrations, and other things into the structure. Well, it's been a great pleasure, Tony. It's so good of you to give us the time on this lovely Friday afternoon in June to
My pleasure.
Explore things. A great joy.